Hello and welcome everybody to a new episode of the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I'm your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Alpha Global. Delighted to have with us today Alexander Streif, who is the Vice President for Supply Chain Management at Northvolt. Northvolt, many of you may know, is a Swedish battery manufacturer and developer specializing in lithium technology for electric vehicles. They're also very much focused on manufacturing with clean energy, with a clear mission to deliver batteries with an 80% lower carbon footprint compared to those made using coal energy. Alexander has been a long-standing professional in supply chain, has done a multitude of roles, has worked in Semicon for many, many years. Then he joined Siemens. Then he had about 6 years also with McKinsey on their operations practice. In the last 2 years, he's been with Northvolt. So great to have you. Thanks for joining us and welcome, Alexander.
Thanks very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Maybe starting a little bit now with your career, and I like to ask you and ask everybody on this podcast, how did you end up in supply chain in the first place?
Very interesting question. So in my case, it was actually an internship, which I was looking for. I went to university in Germany, and then I did an exchange scheme in Wales, in Great Britain. And honestly, after these couple of years of studying, I was a bit fed up with university and I thought maybe it would be a good idea to take a break. So I was looking for a longer internship and I ended up with the German company called Osram, a lighting company, a lighting manufacturer, one of the leading lighting manufacturers back then. And their procurement team was looking for a person who was savvy in databases and data analytics. And we then started, me as an intern with a team of Osram, to build a global data warehouse. And that was actually also then my lead into the organization as my first stop after graduation.
Super. Now, it's also the book we were talking offline, Source to Soul, where we interviewed so many leaders. Not even one had a formal education in supply chain. So that's why it's always fascinating for me how people kind of fall into this. And also, it is encouraging that in recent times with COVID and also the last couple of years, now we have a lot of different programs that are actually proper supply chain programs. So hopefully, we'll see much more intentional people joining from a young graduate and all the way in building careers with examples like yours. Now, another question that I like to ask, looking back, Alexander, what were one or two inflection points in your career?
Yeah. Very good question. So, I mean, one of the first topics, that just to building on what I just said now, when I actually then joined that Excellence, it was a kind of a procurement excellence team in Osram, we built that data warehouse. We basically collected all the procurement data across all entities of all the Osram plants across the world. We integrated them and started making sense out of the data, which was extremely powerful. So my first inflection point was actually very, very early in this, and I understood how powerful data could be. And this also helped me a little bit through my entire career, that data-driven, fact-based decision-making is a very powerful means for taking the right decision. So we started then building actually around that data. We launched an entire transformation of the Osram procurement team. And it was really interesting to see how the entire organization also was starting perceiving the importance of procurement and how procurement could drive a value in the organization and ultimately also drive the entire organization, because we found out quite a lot of spend was not really managed. It was decentralized. It was not consolidated. Besides all the risks in this, it was obviously also leverage for better financial results. So the following transformation of the Osram procurement organization also was very much driven out of that data. We as a small team of students started to build and then leverage. And the other part of that is that we made this data also available to everybody in the procurement organization globally. So there was no constraint really, besides the internal spend, obviously, which has some transfer pricing aspects to it. But generally, we made it available and people started using it. And we helped the people using it. This was also a big part of my initial career, where I then was touring all the sites of Osram globally and helped the people to use the tool and to understand what's in it. Very rewarding as well. And this then basically really helped the organization to deliver on their plan on procurement results. Following then, I spent some years in a category management role. And this was also a kind of a really new role which we created out of the data analytics. It was the merchandise. So products Osram did not manufacture themselves. We purchased them from other light manufacturers. And we found out that this is quite a considerable part of the overall spend, which was not managed. So in the end, I created my next job by finding out that this has been unmanaged. And I thought it would be a great idea to join a team which was managing that spend. So it's also a kind of a learning that you always could look into what you're doing and try to find out what's next and what could come out of that role next. And that is less dependent on others bringing you opportunities. You're creating your opportunities yourself. Then really speak about an inflection point. So after category manager, I was a couple of years in France managing the procurement team of our French operations, and then moved on to Malaysia, where I then hit actually completely the different end of technology. While France was incandescent lamps, it was a kind of a dying technology. We celebrated the 100th birthday while I was there. And a year later, actually, the European Union decided to ban them. So it was also very frustrating, honestly, to see. On the other side, I mean, it forced also a kind of a transition. And that transition I made myself by joining then Osram Opto Semiconductors in Malaysia, where I was heading the procurement team. And to come to your question, while I was there, actually, my daughter got diagnosed with cancer. And we had to go back. So after 3.5 years, there was no question. And this was a big inflection point in my career, where I basically then said, okay, family first, you need to put priorities. We basically came back, got her treated. She's now 19. Everything is good. So nothing left from that period. But it showed very clearly, you need to take decisions for yourself. And the decision was, okay, even unknown what's next in my career, we go back. And I was really grateful for the big, very good network within Osram and Siemens. And I ended up in a Siemens entity, which was pretty close to my hometown, where we then decided to basically settle. And I took that role then as a supply chain head there. And it was not necessarily an upstep, but in these kind of situations, you need to take these decisions. And I was very happy to have that situation that Siemens had an operation there and I could join them.
Mm. Fascinating, really. Now, a little bit double-clicking on Northvolt. So you've been there for 2 years. Electric vehicles are booming. Battery technologies and the development of the batteries for the electric vehicles is, well, in some ways, it's also the Achilles heel. I mean, we definitely need batteries to power the cars. Maybe talk to us a little bit about your journey in the last 2 years, and specifically, if I was to ask you, what are you most proud of in setting and growing the supply chain organization in Northvolt?
So I joined Northvolt a little bit less than 2 years ago. And I mean, we have been in some dialogue. They contacted me while I was with McKinsey. And honestly, I liked my McKinsey job. I had a good role there. I was an expert consulting role and also full of new things, of you working in different industries, bringing the expertise to the teams. So that was not a kind of, I'm now really keen to do something new. So it came more in as an opportunity. And they contacted me through LinkedIn. And honestly, I've never heard of them before. I bumped on the website, checked them out, and I just said, oh, wow, that's an amazing story. And that story was about, let's build the most sustainable batteries, as you said in your intro, and help that transition to electric mobility happen, which I think has so much purpose in the mission, that it just sounded too good to be true. So we discussed for some while, we engaged here, and there was ultimately then the trip coming to Stockholm, and then Västerås, where we have our R&D facilities. Because, I mean, coming out of a consulting environment and prior, I was in these large corporate structures, it's also about credibility and believing, and are these things really tangible? I mean, in a startup environment, it could also be perceived, yes, that's a lot which is shown on a web page, but I found out this is really true. And I think this company has so much dedication. So back then we were around 1,000 employees, and I decided to take it because I was also at that moment, now consulting, most probably I wouldn't be doing for my entire life. It was very intense. I really enjoyed it. It was really fun years, but it was also maybe nothing you want to do until you retire. At least for me, it was not the real option. So going back into the classical corporate structures, also some of them I've got to know a bit better during my consulting career, didn't also sound very appealing to me. So this startup opportunity also with an opportunity. And this is a kind of a principle in Northvolt that we make employees potential or future shareholders. That really attracted my interest. And then I decided to join. After that took a sea trip where I got to know many, many very interesting people in the early days, some of which I still work with nowadays. And that excited me so much. So it was a kind of one-time must-do opportunity. And yeah, then I joined April 2021 in the midst of COVID on a kind of a commuting scheme between Germany and Sweden. Not that easy, but manageable. And it's great. So Northvolt, what we did then when I joined, we had a bit of a separated structure of planning, logistics and procurement. And we decided let's build one team out of it. So we integrated as a kind of a first activity, the planning logistics team, the material and components procurement team, which also involves the supplier quality team, the equipment procurement team. And we had a little bit of dotted lines into some other teams like construction procurement. The one thing I did from the very beginning was also based on my early experience, how important the excellence functions are. We really founded a supply chain excellence team, which had has still the responsibility to grow all our digitization landscape, all our tools, all our processes. I mean, Northvolt is a startup or used to be a startup. We are now more kind of a unicorn in scaling, and we are aiming to also go public sooner or later. So we are building a lot of processes and tools into the organization, which will also be a prerequisite not only to meet these requirements of going public, but also to meet our ability to scale. We can't scale proportionally in terms of resources when we continue how we possibly did in the early days, our transaction. And therefore, technology, digitization, let's say, enabled processes, that's all super crucial. So that function we founded, and that was how we started. And when I joined, we were around 60 people. Now we have doubled since then. But also the entire organization, as I said, was around 1,000 people when I joined. Now Northvolt has more than 4,000 people. And I mean, also from a kind of an activity, we were still in construction mode in our gigafactory up in Skellefteå, which is about 200 kilometers south of the polar or the Arctic Circle. And now we are manufacturing there. So it's extremely rewarding to be part of it. And it was a fun story so far. When you speak about achievements, so I think the first achievement which made me happy, and I think this is maybe some learning I also would like to share. So coming in from a kind of a side door into an organization and being responsible to reshape the organization does not necessarily create applause everywhere in the organization. And so what is important, I think, is you come in, heard things, you have spoken to people before you joined, and you might have spoken to people while you're in the onboarding process, and you start making up your picture on how this should look like. So my biggest learning was, okay, don't preempt discussions, be open and try to listen to the people very carefully who were part of that. Try also to differentiate, let's say, organizational or structural feedback from individual emotions and agendas, and then make up your mind on how this should look like. And I think we had a kind of a tough time in the beginning, but I also got to know the people much better in that. But we ended up, I think, with a quite a good setup in the new structure, with a quite a good setup in terms of leadership. And I think this is my best team I had ever. And I can only give a lot of kudos to the team where we are right now. I think we really have evolved. There's still so much to do. It's incredible what we have ahead of us. So it's also important to build on people who are very passionate about what they are doing and, like me, really want to make this happen. And I strongly believe if we can't make it, I'm not sure who can make it.
There is a great book from... I forget now the name of the... He's the one of the best coaches in the world. What got you here won't get you there. You know who I'm talking about for a moment. Marshall Goldsmith. And I read that book, and where I wanted to ask you also in these fast growing companies like Northvolt, where, like you said, you started with 60 people, now you have doubled. The company was 1,000, now you have 4,000. The factory was being built. Now you have an operating facility. What was some of your key lessons, I guess, And also, I'm pretty sure that the organization you have today won't necessarily be the organization that you will have in 1 year from now, nor will that be the one that you'll need in 2 years from now. What are some of your lessons in terms of how do you constantly adapt and move these pieces?
I think one lesson is you need to have the right skill set in your organization, because, I mean, the changes will be coming. I mean, the most constant thing is most probably the change, especially where we are. And it's very important that you have, let's say, people in your organization who can cope with that. And then that brings me also a bit to the factor of resilience, because not all what is really striking through to the desk or to the head then in the end of each individual or person in the organization, not all of that is really requires the attendance immediately. And I think it's a lot about taking priority decisions. It's a lot about helping people through difficult times and backing them up in the decision making. It's a lot also about letting them go and start, okay, you do, and you start enforcing delegation. Because, I mean, I was not part of that story or that time in the organization when everybody was sitting around the table. I think there it's also very easy to throw topics over the table, to be involved in everything and to have a really full, be like a spider in a web and to have full transparency on what's going on. And I think that the most important thing we need to do most probably is to start delegating, start empowering, and let people do but be there whenever needed, in order with a lot of your experience and possibly your past situations you have managed in a similar way, and just be there but also let them go. I think part of my leadership mantra is, yes, be there, but also let people drive what they want to drive and possibly challenge, but also support them if they want to go a specific direction, that you let them walk that direction, say, okay, I'm not necessarily convinced that this is the right thing to do, but let them also act and try to find out. Then this is something where I believe I was not bad at, and I think it was part of the success story. Yeah.
And thinking and going a little bit in the intricacies of how do you set up the network? How do you set up and think about supply chain networks for an industry that is growing, where there's not enough actually suppliers, and it's not, the ecosystem is still fairly, is being built, but let's call it like that. It's not a mature, it's not like making laptops, which we've been making for a long time, for lack of a better reason. How do you think about, and now I think you guys are also at the point where considering other options, where do you put future facilities? What are some of the principles that go into your mind as the VP of supply chain when you're considering all of this and setting up your supply chain design?
I mean, to understand a bit better where this industry is coming from. So this has been an industry which was very largely dominated out of Asia, and there's China, obviously a very big player, but also South Korea. And for sure, if an industry is predominantly in a specific geography, also the entire supply chain is predominantly in that geography. So that means if you want to start an operation in a completely different geography, your initial potential suppliers, they are coming out of the geography the industry is originating from. And this is what Northvolt was faced with. And it's very clear that our first suppliers were coming from Asia. And we always said that localization of those suppliers is the only way to make these supply chains to work. So that has been a very early focus, far earlier than when I joined. A lot of key projects have been unlocked already before I joined on the localization piece. So that's naturally the first thing to do. You look where the current supply base is. You need to convince them, go with me and come, because it's not possible to ship everything. And that, just for everybody to understand, I mean, we are not speaking small volumes. When we speak about now, we speak about hundred thousands of transportation units every year of materials we will be handling in our network. And that means very clearly also when you have the aspiration not to visit, when you have the aspiration to build the greenest battery on the planet, it can't be a sustainable consequence to have suppliers far out. And I mean, COVID has taught us the next lesson around what can happen to very global supply chains. I mean, we were not in the situation yet of mass manufacturing, so that didn't hit us that much. But COVID, and also then in consequence, the crisis in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, has also cut a couple of our transportation routes. For example, if we needed to ship urgent equipment, for example. So on the equipment side of things, we have struggled, and this was a stretch to our schedules to get equipment from Asia in on time when certain routes were not available, when certain transportation possibilities, such as flying large goods with Antonov, for example, were not available. So it has taught us that there are many, many good reasons for having localized supply chains. This is one of the core concepts we are driving. It's a very important thing for us. Then the other aspect which will drive your access to supply will be joint development. So we systematically, now I'm speaking a bit about the equipment area, but this also is true for materials, obviously. Now we very systematically scan the market and looked where are players in the equipment industry which do similar processes as they are needed in the battery manufacturing, in other adjacent industries, also looking for possibly industries which are on a declining trend, so that there is also strong interest from the potential suppliers to invest into something new. And we are now driving a number of, let's say, joint developments, not only with European suppliers, but focusing on Europe, since we want to also build a European supply chain on the equipment side of things. So that's another means and lever you can actually take or drive to enlarge your potential supplier base. But what comes in all of that, just looking at the magnitude of this industry, how it will grow and how much volume this will be and how much investment is needed actually into the supply chain, that basically means that the only way you can do that is with partnering. So there's no way we can consider this industry to be transactional. I mean, we are ultimately in the automotive industry. In some cases, in my past experience, I have felt how transactional automotive can be. We can't do that. We are in this together. We have a kind of a surgery at an open heart, which we need to be successful in. Otherwise, this whole thing will inflate. And I think that therefore, it's very, very important to build partnership. And partnerships start with trust, and partnerships start with common belief. And partnership basically needs a lot of energy, drive. And also in every partnership, you will have periods of excitement, but there are also periods of pain. But I think the most important thing is, yes, we are in this together. We can't just go to the next best option. These are all relationships you need to develop and you need to make successful.
Just today on the panel, on the event that I was at, there was an example with just in time and the Toyota model. And to your point with partnership, the person that was bringing up the example was very clear that only worked and still works, and it works well for Toyota because of trust, because there is a high level of underpinned trust between Toyota and their ecosystem, that Toyota will not go to the next 10 cent cheaper provider just because. And then when you have that vested interest together with a part, and which is actually the basis of a partnership, and you have the trust, then of course your tier one, tier two, tier three, they will go with you. They will put the factory next to you. There's an innate relationship that makes this happen, which cannot be formed on the basis of transactional. Now, there is another layer that's talked about everywhere pretty much, which is geopolitics. And you actually activate in an industry, and from the raw materials to a lot of the different elements of batteries there's a lot of calling a spade control from China. They've invested very well and they've done it at the global scale. How do you plan for that? And obviously Europe is kind of, you know, also kind of caught in some ways. You have US, you have all these factors. How do you de-risk from that geopolitical perspective, or how do you plan for that even?
It's a very tough question. I think there is no silver bullet answer to do that. I think it's about diversification, right? It's about looking, okay, where are the options you have globally? I think in some areas, this is, I think, no secret, you will be dependent on specific geographies, and it's very difficult to solve them. But it starts all with a proper understanding on where you are dependent and possibly also vulnerable. And then you basically try to dig deeper into the supply chain. So you go upstream, you try to understand what kind of materials were processed and were produced. And that picture is a very important picture to understand, because you might not necessarily have the bottleneck in a tier one. You might have the bottleneck in a in a tier two, in a tier three, in a tier five, and having a proper understanding basically what our demand is, but also what the industry's demand is, where the capacities are developing. That's a very good starting point to understand. But coming back to the dependencies, I think in the past, it has worked quite well because there was some kind of a win-win in being dependent on each other. And I would not necessarily say a dependency is a bad thing if everybody uses this dependency in the proper sense and also to the benefit of both partners. And then we are back to partnership. So partnership or dependencies create also proximity to a certain extent, which I think we need to get back to. It is, from my point of view, very difficult to basically now say we cut everything and we do our own, we start mining. I mean, it's not really realistic. So I think and I really hope that we get back to a kind of a global model, which looks on eye level to each other and also is much more based on looking for, okay, what kind of opportunities can we create out of a dependencies rather than what kind of harm can we put on others as a kind of a threat or a weapon, so to say. It's for sure a very complex situation. We are basically looking into different sources from different geographies wherever we can. And on the cathode side of things, for example, since we are vertically integrated, not all cell manufacturers are vertically integrated. We also look into opportunities to be more tolerant in our manufacturing process, what kind of materials we can take, whether that's really the raw metal or it's a kind of a downstream processed material. So these kind of mechanisms definitely help to cope better with these kind of things. But yes, it's a tough time we are having ahead, and we are building similar with what we're doing on the metal, on the materials and component side. We are also looking very clearly on the equipment side of things, and we are trying to de-risk through building relationships and partnerships across all these geographies, always in good intent and with the belief, yes, these are sustainable partnerships. And I'm not basically preferring the one over the other. We need to go into any direction here.
Now, moving to the last couple of questions for the interview. On the topic of talent and having the people to operate the plants and the work that you do, which is, again, you talked about some sort of sunset industries where you went and partnered from a co-development perspective. In many ways, it's similar. It's looking at the skills which are closest to what you need from a different industry, because, again, there wasn't so many battery manufacturing facilities in Europe, for sure. Maybe they were in Asia, but even there, you know, there's not so much talent. So how do you, or where do you look? What kind of cross-industry skills do you look for? And how do you also groom them to be capable to support the type of growth you need?
I mean, when we look at the battery manufacturing process, and as I just mentioned, we are vertically integrated, so we do the cathode ourselves. This is in principle a chemical plant. And then you go into a kind of the coating process, which is a kind of a continuous processing. And then you move into more discrete kind of cell assembly style equipment, which is a discrete manufacturing process. And then when you really dissect this end to end, you will find a lot of industries which do similar stuff, right? Okay, as I mentioned, cathode is maybe closer to a chemical plant. Then the coating part, there's a lot of coating in packaging and other industries. And if it comes to discrete manufacture, obviously semiconductors is using a similar pick and place stuff. So that's how we go about it and try to find in adjacent industries talent. Initially, for sure, when all this started way before I joined, the team has scouted a lot for obviously talents out of the battery industry, because I mean, you can't source a cell designer out of a different industry. This is a kind of a difficult situation. And I believe Northvolt has been very early successful to get the right people on board, who also had a network and brought some more people in. It will not work sustainably because this entire industry is growing, and also the incumbents will hold to their talent and for good reasons, and it will be more and more difficult to convince people. So we are a little bit on a hybrid path now. So we hire, especially on the engineering side of things, or people also from other companies, not necessarily in the battery industry. And we have also developed a kind of an academy where we are, let's say, skilling up people internally with our knowledge, what we have already acquired, and grow, so to say, the next generation of cell designers or process engineers and so on. I think that's very important in times of scarcity of resources. And it's very important that you invest yourself also into into scaling up. The other thing is obviously academia. Partnerships with academia will help into this. And I think what Europe is now doing or has announced with the Green Deal Industrial Plan to also really build skills and invest into skill building is a very important element. I think this is something which needs to happen as a kind of a network between academia, between the industry, and you need to invest at all ends to get the next generation of skilled people into the organization. Then the other very important factor is, I think, that you need to, and this is what Northvolt has done brilliantly, I believe, we have been able to attract so many really good talents. One factor is that I would say most of the recruiting actually happens out of our own talent team, which is amazing. I mean, I was part of that when I was hired myself, part of that process, and I have never had such similar process with any other company I joined. And coming out of McKinsey, where a lot of investment was made into finding the right people, I think we are doing almost similar kind of due diligence and process to it, which is very exciting to see. And that also helps you to bring in people and focus to pinpoint people and to find them and or to scout them at the right place where they are. The third aspect is obviously also to have a kind of an attractive brand. So a lot of what makes our success and our ability to attract talent nowadays, and we speak here about Generation Y and Z and so on, is about, yes, there is a big purpose. And when looking back at my own career, I need to reflect that I was not driven by that. I mean, there were certain no-goes areas when I got contacted by headhunters in the defense industry. This doesn't necessarily basically attracted my interest. But I think nowadays, young talents are much more focused on also what does that company stand for? How is that company living up to its own aspirations? And what's the mission and the vision of this company? And I think we have here a kind of a competitive advantage with what we are doing that resonates quite well with a lot of people. We also have a responsibility here. We are fully aware to live up to our aspirations. And I think that also creates kind of more interest and a good way which we can tap on when it comes to hiring the right resources into the organization.
Well said. And I mean, some great case studies. And I mean, our core business is executive search and headhunting. And in some selfish way, I'm glad that not so many companies are able to do what you do, because we would be out of business. But super that it works super well for Northvolt. Final question for you, Alexander. What would be one piece of advice? So your daughter is 19. What would be one piece of advice that you'll give your daughter for a long and successful career, and maybe other students or other young professionals would benefit from?
And my daughter might be not the greatest example here, since I think she will do something entirely different to what I have done. It has also, from a work-life balance point of view, not always been great. But I think that's also so very important. I did it myself. I mean, I started because I was really fed up with school after finishing school. And then I just did an apprenticeship and I learned to be a carpenter back then and did really a proper apprenticeship, 2 years working in the workshop, working on construction sites and so on. And I think that gave me a kind of a very good impression on where real life in specific industries is, right? And how it is to work on a shop floor. And I enjoyed it a lot. It also gave me a good break between school and university. I always wanted to study. That was not the question, but I think it was a good thing to do. So I believe starting a career, learning a trade or doing an apprenticeship is nothing wrong. I felt we have a little bit of a tendency over the last 20 years to get people earlier out of school, to get them earlier to university, and get them earlier out of university. We also have a tendency, and I think France has realized that very much, that especially in some of the, let's say, professions which require an apprenticeship, which not necessarily mean any graduation, that this needs to be supported. And I'm really fully supportive of that. We need to get back to that understanding that this is as valuable as being an engineer, right? First thing. The second thing is, go off also after your heart and not necessarily let others drive you what you do. So as I said, I did my apprenticeship and then I did something completely different. Went to university, studied business administration with this focus on, let's say, business informatics and industrial engineering. And that really opened up also my vision for something else. So then basically at university, I was super focused. Hey, I think marketing is a great job to do. Why not to do marketing? And then I ended up in that internship I told you earlier in procurement, and I only found out how exciting procurement could be. So try things, right? Fish here and there, try it out, do internship, look left and right. There is so much to explore. Second thing is, it's about how to go through a career. I mean, a lot of careers typically go only up, only in one direction, right? You start as a kind of individual contributor, then you start into a kind of a team management role, you go into a larger management role, and so on. I did it myself in the end. After a couple of years of individual contributor, I started managing people. But there are some more other things to grow. I believe we need to push more this kind of expert careers as well, and also position them right in the companies, from both from a grading point of view, but also from a prestige point of view. It's still too often that the only career path can go into management direction. But I believe to really work well in an organization, you need people who bring expertise, experience, and bring that not necessarily with the aspiration to lead people. Not every good engineer is a good manager. Not every good buyer would be a good team lead for a purchasing team, and similarly in planning and logistics. So I believe it's very important to build this kind of career path, and then as an individual, also to take these opportunities, right? So I had these kind of side steps in my career where I was basically doing the same thing, but for a different category or in a different geography. And that also basically gave me so much rewarding experience, knowledge, and capabilities, which then helped me again at a later stage in my career in a completely different setup. And then the third thing is, it doesn't sound super smart in a very fast world and agile world, also take your time. Going your way and growing is also energy intense. You need sometimes breaks. You need to have phases where you can build on kind of a fast scale development. And you have a kind of a, not a real break, but at least a kind of a period of time where you can start building on that. We can't run marathons at sprints forever. I myself have experienced that, and I think it's very important. For me, typically the hardest time on your job was like the first year or maybe the first 18 months. So if you then jump onto your next challenge, like after 24 months, it might not always be the right thing to do. Perfectly fine when you do these kind of side steps and getting more comprehensive knowledge on a kind of a similar level. If you basically go through the career, at least I made that experience, and I'm also seeing it in some, or saw it in some of my teams, I think it's very important to take the right level of aspiration. It's super good and super important to be aspirational, but it's also important to leave a legacy where you are. And the first year, typically you invest a lot and you learn a lot. And then comes only the time when you really build on it.
Love it. Try things. Nothing wrong with being an expert carpenter. And now, thank God, with TikTok and all of this, you can be the carpenter on TikTok. Actually, I mean, I'm using your example, but I'm serious. So there's so many paths in which somebody that's extremely talented in something, whatever that might be, can turn into a gold mine, and they don't need to be the CEO, CSCO, managing hundreds of people. Nothing like that. And thirdly, love it. Take your time, and it's a marathon. Don't run it as if you're running sprints all the time. On that note, Alex, thanks a lot for the time. A really awesome sharing. Keep innovating. Keep building the future. We need it definitely for a green future for all of us, and making a dent at Northvolt. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking. And I mean, there's a lot of open opportunities, not only in my organization, but in Northvolt in general. So watch out. It's an interesting place to be right now.
Super.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.